The Rising Tide of Colour Against White World Supremacy by Lothrop Stoddard, Part 11. This extended discussion of the evil effects of even white immigration has, in my opinion, been necessary in order to get a proper perspective for viewing the problem of coloured immigration. For it is perfectly obvious that if the influx of inferior kindred stocks is bad, the influx of wholly alien stocks is infinitely worse. When we see the damage wrought in America, for example, by the coming of persons who, after all, belong mostly to branches of the white race, and who nearly all possess the basic ideals of white civilization, we can grasp the incalculably greater damage which would be wrought by the coming of persons wholly alien in blood and possessed of idealistic and cultural backgrounds absolutely different from ours. If the white immigrant can gravely disorder the national life, it is not too much to say that the coloured immigrant would doom it to certain death. This doom would be all the more certain because of the enormous potential volume of coloured immigration. Beside it, the white immigrant tide of the past century would pale into insignificance, leaving all other parts of the coloured world out of the present discussion. Three Asiatic countries, China, Japan, and India, together have a population of nearly 800 million. That is practically twice the population of Europe, the source of white immigration, and the vast majority of these 800 million Asiatics are potential immigrants into white territories. Their standards of living are so inconceivably low, their congestion is so painful, and their consequent desire for relief so keen that the high-standard, relatively empty white world seems to them a perfect paradise. Only the barrier of the white man's veto has prevented a perfect deluge of coloured men into white lands, and even as it is, the desperate seekers after fuller life have crept and crawled through every crevice in that barrier, until even these advance guards today constitute serious local problems along the white world's race frontiers. The simple truth of the matter is this: a mighty problem, a planet-wide problem, confronts us today and will increasingly confront us in the days to come, says Putnam Wheel. A struggle has begun between the white man and all the other men of the world to decide whether non-white men, that is, yellow men or brown men or black, may or may not invade the white man's countries in order there to gain their livelihood. The standard of living being low in the lands of coloured men and high in the lands of the white man, it has naturally followed that it has been in the highest degree attractive for men of colour during the past few decades to proceed to regions where their labour is rewarded on a scale far above their actual requirements, that is, on the white man's scale. This simple economic truth creates the inevitable contest which has for years filled all the countries bordering on the Pacific with great dread, and which, in spite of the temporary truce which the so-called exclusion policy has now enforced, will go much farther than it has yet gone. The worldwide significance of coloured immigration and the momentous conflicts which it will probably provoke are ably visualised by Professor Ross. The rush of developments, he writes, makes it certain that the vision of a globe lapped in universal law is premature. If the seers of the mid-century, who looked for the speedy triumph of free trade, had read their Malthus aright, they might have anticipated the tariff barriers that have arisen on all hands within the last 30 years. So, today one needs no prophet's mantle to foresee that presently the world will be cut up with immigration barriers, which will never be levelled until the intelligent accommodation of numbers to resources has greatly equalised population pressure all over the globe. Dams against the colour races, with spillways, of course, for students, merchants and travellers, will presently enclose the white man's world. Within this area, minor dams will protect the high wages of the less prolific peoples against the surplus labour of the more prolific. Assuredly, every small family nation will try to raise such a dam, and every big family nation will try to break it down. The outlook for peace and disarmament is, therefore, far from bright. One needs but compare the population pressures in France, Germany, Russia and Japan to realise that, even today, the real enemy of the dove of peace is not the eagle of pride or the vulture of greed, but the stork. The great point of doubt in birth restriction is the ability of the Western nations to retain control of the vast African, Australasian and South American areas they have staked out as preserves to be peopled at their leisure with a diminishing overflow of their population. If underbreeding should leave them without the military strength that alone can defend their far-flung frontiers in the southern hemisphere, those huge underdeveloped regions will assuredly be filled with the children of the brown and the yellow races. Thus, white men of whatever country and however far removed from personal contact with coloured competitors must realise that the question of coloured immigration vitally concerns every white man, woman and child, because nowhere, absolutely nowhere, can white labour compete on equal terms with coloured immigrant labour. The grim truth is that there are enough hard-working coloured men to swamp the entire white world. No palliatives will serve to mitigate the ultimate issue, for if the white race should today surrender enough of its frontiers to ease the existing coloured population pressure, so quickly would these surrendered regions be swamped, and so rapidly would the fast-breeding coloured races fill the homeland gaps, that in a very short time the diminished white world would be faced with an even louder coloured clamour for admittance, backed by an increased power to enforce the coloured will. The profoundly destructive effects of coloured competition upon white standards of labour and living has long been admitted by all candid students of the problem. So warm a champion of Asiatics as Mr. Hindman acknowledges that the white workers cannot hold their own permanently against Chinese competition in the labour market. The lower standard of life, the greater persistence, the superior education of the Chinese will beat them and will continue to beat them. Wherever the white man has been exposed to coloured competition, particularly Asiatic competition, the story is the same, says the Australian Professor Pearson. No one in California or Australia, where the effects of Chinese competition have been studied, has, I believe, the smallest doubt that Chinese labourers, if allowed to come in freely, could starve all the white men in either country out of it, or force them to submit to harder work and a much lower standard of wages. And a South African, writing of the effects of Hindu immigration into Natal, remarks in similar vein. The condition of South Africa, especially of Natal, is a warning to other lands to bar Asiatic immigrants. Both economically and socially, the presence of a large Oriental population is bad. The Asiatics either force out the white workers or compel the latter to live down to the Asiatic level. There must be a marked deterioration among the white working classes, which renders useless a great deal of the effort made in educational work. The white population is educated and trained according to the best ideas of the highest form of Western civilization, and has to compete for a livelihood against Asiatics. In South Africa, this competition is driving out the white working class, because the average European cannot live down to the Asiatic level, and if it is essential that the European must do so, for the sake of his own happiness, do not educate him up to better things. If cheapness is the only consideration, if low wages are to come before everything else, then it is not only a waste of money, but absolute cruelty to inspire in the white working classes tastes and aspirations which it is impossible for them to realise. To meet Asiatic competition squarely, it would be necessary to train the white children to be Asiatics. Even the pro-Orientals would hardly advocate this. The lines just quoted squarely counter the survival of the fittest plea, so often made by Asiatic propagandists for coloured immigration. The argument runs that, since the Oriental labourer is able to underbid the white labourer, the Oriental is the fittest, and should therefore be allowed to supplant the white man in the interests of human progress. This is, of course, merely clever use of the well-known fallacy, which confuses the terms fittest and best. The idea that, because a certain human type fits in certain ways a particular environment, and often an unhealthy man-made social environment, it should be allowed to drive out another type, endowed with much richer potentialities for the highest forms of human evolution. It is a sophistry as absurd as it is dangerous. Professor Ross puts the matter very aptly when he remarks concerning Chinese immigration. The competition of white labourer and yellow is not so simple a test of human worth as some may imagine. Under good conditions, the white man can best the yellow man in turning off work, but under bad conditions, the yellow man can best the white man, because he can better endure spoiled food, poor clothing, foul air, noise, heat, dirt, discomfort, and microbes. Riley can outdo Arsène, but Arsène can underlive Riley. Arsène cannot take away Riley's job as being a better workman, but because he can live and do some work at a wage on which Riley cannot keep himself fit to work at all, three or four Arsènes can take Riley's job from him. And they will do it, too, unless they are barred out of the market where Riley is selling his labour. Riley's endeavour to exclude Arsène from his labour market is not the case of a man dreading to pit himself on equal terms against a better man. Indeed, it is not quite so simple and selfish and narrow-minded as all that. It is a case of a man fitted to get the most out of good conditions, refusing to yield his place to a weaker man able to withstand bad conditions. All this is no disparagement of the Asiatic. He is perfectly justified in trying to win broader opportunities in white lands, but we whites are equally justified in keeping these opportunities for ourselves and for our children. The hard facts are that there is not enough for both, that when the enormous outward thrust of coloured population pressure bursts into a white land, it cannot let live, but automatically crushes the white man out, first the white labourer, then the white merchant, and lastly the white aristocrat, until every vestige of white has gone from that land forever. This inexorable process is thus described by an Australian. The coloured races become agencies of economic disturbance and social degradation. They sap and destroy the upward tendencies of the poorer whites. The latter, instead of always having something better to look at and strive after, have a lower standard of living, health and cleanliness set before them, and the results are disastrous. They sink to the lower level of the Asiatics, and the degrading tendency proceeds upwards by saturation, affecting several grades of society. There is an insidious yet irresistible process of social degradation. The coloured race does not intentionally or even consciously lower the European. It simply happens so by virtue of a natural law which neither race can control. As debased coinage will drive out good currency, so a lowered standard of living will inexorably spread until its effects are universally felt. It all comes down to a question of self-preservation, and despite what sentimentalists may say, self-preservation is the first law of nature. To love one's cultural, idealistic, and racial heritage, to swear to pass that heritage unimpaired to one's children, to fight, and if need be, to die in its defence, all this is eternally right and proper, and no amount of casuistry or sentimentality can alter that unalterable truth. An Englishman put the thing in a nutshell when he wrote, "Asiatic immigration is not a question of sentiment, but of sheer existence. The whole problem is summed up in Lafcadio Hearn's pregnant phrase, the East can underlive the West." Rigorous exclusion of coloured immigrants is thus vitally necessary for the white peoples. Unfortunately, this exclusion policy will not be easily maintained. Coloured population pressure is insistent and increasing, while the matter is still further complicated by the fact that, while no white community can gain by coloured immigration, white individuals, employers of labour, may be great gainers, and hence often tend to put private interest above racial duty. Barring a handful of sincere but misguided cosmopolitan enthusiasts, it is unscrupulous business interests which are behind every white proposal to relax the exclusion laws protecting white areas. In fairness to these business interests, however, let us realise their great temptations. To the average employer, especially in the newer areas of white settlement, where white labour is scarce and dictatorial, what could be more enticing than the vision of a boundless supply of cheap and eager coloured labour? Consider this Californian appraisement of the Chinese coolie. "The Chinese coolie is the ideal industrial machine, the perfect human ox. He will transform less food into more work, with less administrative friction than any other creature. Even now, when the scarcity of Chinese labour and the consequent rise in wages have eliminated the question of cheapness, the Chinese have still the advantage over all the other servile labour in convenience and efficiency. They are patient, docile, industrious, and above all, honest, in the business sense that they keep their contracts. Also, they cost nothing but money. Any other sort of labour costs human effort and worry in addition to the money. But Chinese labour can be bought like any other commodity at so much a dozen or a hundred. The Chinese contractor delivers the agreed number of men at the agreed time and place for the agreed price, and if anyone should drop out, he finds another in his place. The men board and lodge themselves, and when the work is done, they disappear from the employer's ken until again needed. The entire transaction consists in paying the Chinese contractor an agreed number of dollars for an agreed result." This elimination of the human element reduces the labour problem to something the employer can understand. The Chinese labour machine, from his standpoint, is perfect. What is true of the Chinese is true to a somewhat lesser extent of all coolie labour. Hence, once introduced into a white country, it becomes immensely popular among employers. How it was working out in South Africa before the Exclusion Acts there is clearly explained in the following lines. The experience of South Africa is that when once Asiatic labour is admitted, the tendency is for it to grow. One manufacturer secures it and is able to cut prices to such an extent that the other manufacturers are forced either to employ Asiatics also or to reduce white wages to the Asiatic level. Oriental labour is something which does not stand still. The taste for it grows. A party springs up financially interested in increasing it. In Natal today, the suggestion that Indian labour should no longer be imported is met by an outcry from the planters, the farmers and the landowners and a certain number of manufacturers that industries and agriculture will be ruined. So the coolie ships continue to arrive at Durban, and Natal becomes more and more a land of black and brown people and less a land of white people. Instead of becoming a Canada or a New Zealand, it is becoming a Trinidad or a Cuba. Instead of white settlers, there are brown settlers. The working class white population has to go, as it is going, in Natal. The country becomes a country of white landlords and supervisors, controlling a horde of Asiatics. It does not produce a nation or a free people. It becomes what in the old days of English colonization was called a plantation. All this gives a clearer idea of the difficulties involved in a successful guarding of the gates. But it also confirms the conviction that the gates must be strictly guarded. If anything further were needed to reinforce that conviction, it should be the present state of those white outposts where the gates have been left ajar. Hawaii is a good example. This mid-Pacific archipelago was brought under white control by masterful American Nordics who established Anglo-Saxon institutions and taught the natives the rudiments of Anglo-Saxon civilization. The native Hawaiians, like the other Polynesian races, could not stand the pressure of white civilization and withered away. But the white oligarchy, which controlled the islands, determined to turn their marvellous fertility to immediate profit. Labour was imported from the ends of the earth, the sole test being working ability without regard to race or colour. There followed a great influx of Asiatic labour, at first Chinese, until annexation to the United States brought Hawaii under our Chinese exclusion laws. Later on, Filipinos, Koreans, and above all, Japanese. The results are highly instructive. These Asiatics arrived as agricultural labourers to work on the plantations, but they did not stay there. Saving their wages, they pushed vigorously into all the middle walks of life. The Hawaiian fisherman and the American artisan or shopkeeper were alike ousted by ruthless undercutting. Today, the American mechanic, the American storekeeper, the American farmer, even the American contractor is a rare bird indeed, while Japanese corporations are buying up the finest plantations and growing the finest pineapples and sugar. Fully half the population of the islands is Japanese, while the Americans are being literally encysted as a small and dwindling aristocracy. In 1917, the births of the two races were American, 295, Japanese, 5,000. Comment is superfluous. Clear round the globe, the island of Mauritius, the halfway house between Asia and Africa, tells the same tale. Originally settled by Europeans, mostly French, Mauritius imported Negroes from Africa to work its rich soil. This at once made impossible the existence of a white labouring class, though the upper, middle and artisan classes remained unaffected by the economically backward blacks. 100 years ago, 1/3 of the population were whites. But after the abolition of slavery, the Negroes quit work and Asiatics were imported to take their place. The upshot was that the whites were presently swamped beneath the Asiatic tide, here mostly Hindus. Today, the Hindus alone form more than two-thirds of the whole population, the whites numbering less than one-tenth. Indeed, the very outward aspect of the island is changing. The old French landmarks are going, and the fabled land of Paul and Virginia is becoming a bit of Hindustan with a Chinese fringe. Even Port Louis, the capital town, has mostly passed from white to Indian or Chinese hands. Now, what do these two world-sundered cases mean? They mean, as an English writer justly remarks, that under the British flag, Mauritius has become an outpost of Asia, just as Hawaii is another such, and under the Stars and Stripes. And of course, there is Natal, already mentioned, which at the moment, when the recent South African Exclusion Act stayed the Hindu tide, had not only been partially transformed into an Asiatic land, but was fast becoming a centre of Asiatic radiation all over South Africa. With such grim warnings before their eyes, it is not strange that the lusty young Anglo-Saxon communities bordering the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, British Columbia, and our own coast, have one and all set their faces like flint against the Oriental, and have emblazoned across their portals the legend, All White. Nothing is more striking than the instinctive and instantaneous solidarity which binds together Australians and Afrikaners, Californians and Canadians into a sacred union at the mere whisper of Asiatic immigration. Everywhere, the slogan is the same. The white Australian idea, cries an Antipodean writer, is not a political theory, it is a gospel. It counts for more than religion, for more than a flag, because the flag waves over all kinds of aces, for more than the empire, for the empire is mostly black or brown or yellow, is largely heathen, largely polygamous, partly cannibal. In fact, the White Australia doctrine is based on the necessity for choosing between national existence and national suicide. White Australia, writes another Australian in similar vein. Australians of all classes and political affiliations regard the policy much as Americans regard the Constitution. It is their most articulate article of faith. The reason is not far to seek. Australian civilization is little more than a partial fringe around the continental coastline of 12,210 miles. The coast and its hinterlands are settled and developed, although not completely, for the entire circumference, in the centre of the country, lie the apparently illimitable wastes of the Never Never Land, occupied entirely by scrub, snakes, sand and blackfellows. The almost manless regions of the island continent are a terrible menace. It is impossible to police at all adequately such an enormous area, and the peoples of Asia, beating at the bars that confine them, rousing at last from their age-long slumber, are chafing at the restraints imposed upon their free entry into and settlement of such uninhabited, undeveloped lands. So the Australians, 5 million whites in a far-off continent as large as the United States, defy clamouring Asia and swear to keep Australia a white man's land. Says Professor Pearson, we are guarding the last part of the world in which the higher races can increase and live freely for the higher civilization. We are denying the yellow race nothing but what it can find in the home of its birth or in countries like the Indian archipelago, where the white man can never live except as an exotic. So Australia has raised drastic immigration barriers, conceived on the lines laid down by Sir Henry Parkes many years ago. It is our duty to preserve the type of the British nation, and we ought not for any consideration whatever to admit any element that would detract from, or in any appreciable degree lower, that admirable type of nationality. We should not encourage or admit among us any class of persons whatsoever whom we are not prepared to advance to all our franchises, to all our privileges as citizens, and all our social rights, including the right of marriage. I maintain that no class of persons should be admitted here who cannot come among us, take up all our rights, perform on a ground of equality all our duties, and share in our august and lofty work of founding a free nation.
You're tuned in to Radio Storm.